Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Who wants to be a millionaire? Just about everyone. And just as many seem to enjoy watching people trying to become millionaires, judging by the ratings for ABC's Hot New Game Show. NBC, CBS, and Fox are weighing in with their entries into this game show craze, a craze that is by no means new. In fact, during the last run of primetime game shows during the 1950s, a scandal broke out from which the television game show phenomenon is only now recovering. That's the subject of Dennis Mihalik's interview today with William Boddy. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. A dedicated and revered actor, John Wilkes Booth had a promising future in drama. Nevertheless, during this week in 1865, that future was cut short when Union troops killed him for his assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. Booth, a dedicated Confederate, originally planned to kidnap the president. But as the war dragged on and the Confederacy's defeat seemed inevitable, he and his group of would-be assassins decided instead to avenge what the North had done to his much-beloved homeland by killing Lincoln, Secretary of State William Seward, and Vice President Andrew Johnson. Johnson's intended killer backed out at the last minute, but Seward was seriously wounded. Lincoln, of course, was killed while he attended a play at Washington's Ford Theater. After entering the president's reserved box, Booth shot Lincoln in the back of the head. He shouted, "The South is avenged," and jumped 12 feet to the stage below. Breaking his leg in the process, Booth nevertheless escaped, only to be surrounded 9 days later in a barn in Virginia where he was shot and killed. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the Pentagon has obtained the memoir of a Russian emigre, which says that at least 22 men were held prisoner in Soviet gulags during the 1950s. In 1992, Boris Yeltsin admitted that the Soviet forces had taken American airmen prisoner during the Korean War, but the Kremlin refused to allow investigators into camp archives to investigate the claim. The author of the memoir, a South Korean, now dead, was himself a POW during the war. Almost 100 years after its mysterious disappearance in the waters off Charleston, South Carolina, the Confederate submarine H.L. Hunley has been found at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. The 40-foot submarine made naval history by being the first Confederate submarine to sink a Union ship, the USS Housatonic, on February 17, 1864. Immediately following its successful encounter, however, the submarine disappeared. Now, Mark Reagan, who has spearheaded the recovery efforts, hopes to transport it to a conservation facility where it will be examined for any clues that might explain its disappearance, and then he intends to put it on public display. You're listening to Talking History. Millionaire madness has struck primetime television. On average, more than 30 million viewers watch the new show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And the other networks have game show offerings that are attracting large crowds as well. Primetime game shows haven't been this popular since the 1950s, but then that craze ended with one of the greatest television cheating scandals of all time. Dennis Mihalik spoke with William Boddy about the events that led to that scandal.
Thank you, Brian. This television season has witnessed a resurgence of quiz shows. 40 years ago, the unprecedented popularity of television quiz shows collapsed due to rigging scandals. Here to put those scandals into historical perspective is William Boddy, professor in the speech department at Baruch College of the City University of New York, and the author of 50s Television, published by the University of Illinois Press. Welcome, Professor Boddy.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
How did quiz shows originate?
In the case of television, it was almost accidental. They started in terms of the big money quiz shows, which were extremely popular in the mid-50s. They started with a summer replacement show. In other words, you know, No Great Expectations. And it was itself a show called The $64,000 Question, which was an inflated spinoff of an earlier radio program called The $64 Question. That show became extremely popular in the summer of, it was an immediate hit, in the summer of 1955. It, you know, nosed out I Love Lucy to become the number one show. And by that fall, it had spun off its own show called The $64,000 Challenge and a host of imitators. And it really peaked in the 57-58 season until, gosh, there were 24 quiz shows across the three networks' prime time, amounting, in the case of NBC, to 18% of its entire schedule. And they died just as quickly. By the fall of 1958, all the shows were off, and it really killed the genre for at least a dozen years.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, $64,000, and then on some of the programs like 21 and others, it got up into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And now, you know, we see this want to be a millionaire. I mean, how can they afford to give away so much money?
Well, it was an issue. At some point, Charles Revlon, who was the sponsor of $64,000 Question, would meet every week with the producers and kind of plot out the narratives. He wouldn't literally say, get this person off the air, but he'd say, our ratings are down this week. That's enough of him. In other words, he would leave it supposedly up to the producers to figure out how to knock this person out, which, of course, implied rigging. And one concern was economic. They would rig the shows in various ways to lower winnings. At one point, he said, just have more losers. But even if they were giving away hundreds of thousands of dollars over the weeks of a very successful run, the production costs of the programs were extremely low. That meant that, you know, obviously they had no location shooting, they hired no writers, they hired no actors except for the MC, so that the production values, the production costs, even considering the relatively high awards, were well within, you know, television budgets. So in short answer is they could afford to give it away because they were making huge amounts of money in advertising revenues because the shows themselves were very popular.
Uh-huh. Now, why were the shows rigged then?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. The rationale for rigging was it kind of followed from this notion that these are not exactly what appealed to the audience, at least according to the producers involved, was not simply watching people win or lose money, but rather the old dramatic verities of you have to have interesting characters, you have to have a kind of interesting stage or set. So they spent a lot of time developing elaborate sorts of props like vaults and bank presidents and bank guards and university professors all surrounding the spectacle and isolation booths and all sorts of things. But you wanted to keep popular contestants on the air long, and there was a deathly fear of an unpopular contestant that you couldn't get off. So they would look at this as dramatic actors and directors would. In other words, they would cast for people they thought were interesting. Some of the shows pitched one contestant against another, and often what they would do there would be very, you know, use two stereotype characters and use them to play off another. In other words, a rural character with a city slicker, or, you know, an Ivy League sort of college educator versus a struggling City University of New York student. And so they would create these strong characters and cast them and literally dress them. In the case of the CCNY student, Charles Stemple, the night before his first appearance, the producer came to his house, gave him a Marine Corps haircut, told him to wear an ill-fitting suit that was in his closet, and emphasized falsely how poor Stemple was. And he put that character, who was not the real Charles Stemple, obviously, against Charles Van Doren, who was from a patrician in New York intellectual family, a teaching assistant at Columbia University. And so they played one off the other very effectively. So with that in mind, you need to be able to rig outcomes. In the case of Stemple and Van Doren, they went through a series of ties, extremely improbable ties, to convey the suspense. So in other words, it was very disappointing in the early years, the early episodes of these shows, to have an illustrious character come on, or an interesting character, and fail the first question and simply be escorted off. That didn't make for good dramatic television. And these producers thought of themselves as making dramatic television, you know, as casting, as building an elaborate set, building these long narratives, creating suspense, and really, they said, giving the audience what it wanted.
Mm-hmm. And as I recall from having actually watched these programs, like 21 that you're referring to with Stemple and Van Dorn, they were on the program for weeks on end.
Yes, yes.
So they actually became celebrities.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now,
That was the crucial case. It wasn't, you know, 21 was probably the, they went to probably the most extreme lengths. Dan Enright and Jack Barry went to the most extreme lengths of rigging. They told Stemple not only, you know, get this haircut, wear these clothes, but they coached him on which questions to stumble over, what order to answer questions, how to wipe the perspiration from his brow, which was to pat, not to wipe, in terms of directing an actor just as you would in a dramatic show. The other programs went to different lengths and in different means to rig the outcomes. They would sometimes very commonly do pretests, to, ostensibly to find out what you knew and what areas of strength, and they would simply then lead the questions on the real show toward those areas of strength, or literally ask the same questions which they already knew through these pretests that the contestant could or could not answer. So that was a very, it was relatively minimal. It didn't require the cooperation, explicit cooperation of the contestant, but it was a way to steer the outcomes. In the case of 21, it was flat out, you know, coaching these people and getting them to act, not only in terms of the questions and answers, but also in terms of the dramatic performance to get them to act at every moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, how widespread was the rigging? You talk about, you know, dozens of programs. I mean, did they all rig in some way?
It's hard to know. Manhattan Grand Jury investigated it. And if your viewers or listeners have seen the film Quiz Show, which is a very, you know, a very evocative, very moving, I think, portrayal of that, it misleads viewers, I think, to the extent to which the protagonist, the detective in that movie, Quiz Show, is an employee of the Senate House Oversight Committee. They came in very late and, in fact, did no real detective work. The detective work in terms of uncovering the scandal was done by an assistant district attorney in the city of New York named Joseph Stone, who listened to 150 witnesses, most of them contestants, but a lot of producers and other people associated with the show. And he estimated later that 50 of these 150 witnesses told the truth. And they had lots of different reasons for lying, but mostly not legal reasons. In other words, they weren't going to be charged with something that they admitted they had been coached and so on. It's still difficult, given all the testimony and the grand jury investigation, to know exactly the depths and breadth of the rigging. And I certainly wouldn't want to say that every show was rigged. They were certainly all tarred with the same brush. In other words, all shows, good, bad, rigged or not, were taken off the air in the fall of 1958. But rigging was pretty pervasive. Again, it varied. They would do things like the relatively benign pretest. They did that with children. But they would, you know, one of the ways in which the scandal initially broke was Marie Wynn, who was a contestant on a game show called Dotto, wrote down the answers before they appeared. And one of her standby contestants, who was waiting to go on the show, simply found her crib sheet and brought it to the losing contestant, and they both extorted, you know, thousands of dollars from the TV producers, the show's producers, in exchange for their silence. In the case of Patty Duke, her agent, who was a child actor in the Miracle Worker on Broadway at the time, she was having problem memorizing her coached answers, and her thoughtful agent gave her pen and paper to write them down and took 15% of her cut. So in many cases, the coaching was quite explicit and depended completely on the cooperation of the contestant. And again, in the case of the Quiz Show, the movie, Charles Van Dorn there is presented as an unwilling, at least initially unwilling, collaborator in the coaching and the rigging, and that seems not to be the case. In other words, he was presented with a choice. He chose to, for whatever reasons, to go along with the fraud.
Mm-hmm. Now, when these scandals became public, this rigging became public, was there a huge public outcry against it? Is that why the programs were all pulled?
Yeah. In some ways, it what struck a lot of people ever since. I mean, people who think about the quiz shows, you know, as they've been reincarnated, both in prime time and out of prime time in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, is what seems to be the striking disproportion of response. And the fact that, you know, you had President Eisenhower address the question directly in two press conferences. He ordered a special attorney general investigation of television practices. it was the front page of all the newspapers. It called for denunciations from the pulpit, from university professors, from politicians. And for many viewers since, you know, people reading these articles and speeches, it seems a bit overwrought. And I think it is, one does need to go back to the period and understand that what was at stake was not simply, oh, you mean Charles Van Doren didn't know the answer to the three, you know, the names of the three royalty that he passed or not passed, but rather the whole appeal of these programs and the way in which they, at the time of their popularity, had been presented, what it seemed to mean to people at their height of success, was so very important cluster of ideas, and that when that came crashing down in the terms of the rigging, it seemed like not just the rigging or these quiz shows were at stake, but the entire television industry, and then more importantly, American values in general. They were popular at a very prosperous moment in American life, but a moment when very few heroes were intellectuals. And there was a lot of fear. This was around the time of Sputnik and so on, that America was falling behind in education, particularly in learning and in respect for learning. So, you know, intellectuals were denounced as eggheads and were made fun of in popular culture. So these shows at the time, at the height of their popularity, especially in a case like Charles Van Doren, who was a university instructor and a graduate student in English, he used the success of his performance on 21 to get a $50,000 a year job with NBC on the Today Show reading poetry to people. So at the time, this was considered a real breakthrough and a real kind of maturing of America. That is, that they could make intellectuals and its knowledge itself the real heroes of American programming. So when this collapsed, when it was a fraud, you know, there was a lot more at stake than simply, oh, I never liked that show anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in this collapse then, I mean, were reforms instituted, laws passed to prevent rigging?
Yeah, it's more a question of particular practices. At the time, it wasn't even clear when the grand jury was investigating what the crime they were investigating. And in the congressional testimony and elsewhere, some sponsors, network officials, some of the producers offered various rationales. In other words, no one was defrauded. You know, in other words, it's just like when they make TV Western, they don't use real bullets. You know, no one dies in that television. Is that fraud on a, you know? So clearly there's levels of disingenuousness here. But it wasn't clear from the prosecuting, the people investigating the crimes, who was being defrauded of what. In other words, if the sponsor was happy with the sales of the product, and they clearly were in the case of the sponsors of 21 and the sponsors of $64,000 question, Revlon and a company called Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, the networks were very happy. They were making huge profits based on relatively modest licensing fees for the shows. NBC started acquiring interest in the programs. The program producers were happy. The bribed contestants were happy. And it wasn't clear where the money was coming from, who was being defrauded. In the most general sense, you could say the American public was defrauded because they were expecting to see, you know, contests of skill and chance that were not, wasn't what they were represented. In terms of actual fiscal and regulatory changes, they made the practice of disclosure more important. In other words, you had to disclose preparation, financial interest, such and such was donated on behalf of promotional consideration. So there was interesting disclosure. And then I think the chief fear is that, in terms of cleaning up, was that if these shows are presented as contests of skill or chance, you as producer better make clear that you have that credibility. That is, it's in their interest, if they're presenting it as such, to make sure that there are controls to make it clean. So the strongest incentive is not a federal law or you know, new FCC regulations, but rather, you know, what if the truth comes out again? And I think there is a very real fear that if a show is presented on a certain basis, then it has to, you know, not disappoint its audience.
Well, I'm sorry, but that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Professor William Boddy, author of 50s Television, published by the University of Illinois Press.
And for our site of the week, we continue on our theme of game shows, which are really just another form of gambling, and recommend to you a place on the net where you can learn more about the history of the town in America most commonly associated with gambling. Here to name that town and to tell you about the site devoted to its history is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
When you talk about gambling, logic is sure to be a part of that conversation, behind all that razzle-dazzle, bright lights, and noise lies an interesting history that few probably consider while they are there. For a look at the history behind the city of Las Vegas, try the website devoted to the history of the Las Vegas Strip, lvstriphistory.com. There you will find pictures and information about the earliest hotels and casinos and what has happened to them since. You will also find out the stories behind the developers and the risks they took building them there. Many of the places that started the craze are nothing more than a memory on this wonderfully done internet site. So the next time you're thinking about a trip to Vegas, take a look at some of the history before you get there.
It's now or never. Come hold me tight. Kiss me, my darling.
From gambling to politics, some would say that's not a very big leap. In our op-ed of the week, historian Alvin Finkel asks, which of the presidential hopefuls would provide the greatest continuity with the foreign policy course that typified Western diplomacy in the 20th century? His answer may surprise you.
Which presidential aspirant would provide the greatest continuity with the foreign policy course that typified Western diplomacy in the 20th century? Unfortunately, it's Patrick Buchanan. In his recent book, A Republic, Not an Empire, Buchanan suggests Britain and France should not have declared war against Germany in September 1939, and the United States should not have joined the war in December 1941. In Buchanan's view, the Western powers should have continued appeasing Hitler so that he could have destroyed the Soviet Union. For Buchanan, communism, with its rejection of free enterprise, represented a threat to Western interests, and Nazism and fascism, with their rejection of democracy and individual rights, did not. Following a logic similar to Buchanan's, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain lauded Hitler's military expansion from 1933 to 1939. He presumed that Hitler's aim was to confront the Soviets. Young John F. Kennedy, writing in 1940, summed up the British attitude. During this period, the fear of communism, not of Nazism, was the great British boogie. Germany under Hitler, with its early program of vigorous opposition to communism, was looked on as a bulwark against the spread of the doctrine through Europe. Kennedy knew about the attitudes of the British from his father, Joseph Kennedy, American ambassador to Britain. Joseph Kennedy shared the British mindset regarding Hitler. Franklin Roosevelt did not, but America's foreign policy agenda was driven by men like Kennedy and by isolationists who believed the United States should ignore European conflicts altogether. One influential isolationist was Martin Dies, the Texas congressman who chaired the House Un-American Activities Committee in the late 1930s. UAC was supposed to investigate the activities of all subversive groups in America. In practice, it focused exclusively on the communists, ignoring Nazi and fascist groups because the latter participated in attacks on communists. That perspective, Pat Buchanan's today, might have prevailed beyond 1939, but for Hitler's impatience and paranoia. Britain's going to war with Germany in 1939 ought not to obscure its 6 previous years of supporting Hitler as an opponent of communism. American foreign policy during the Cold War had a similar cast, overthrowing elected leftist regimes in Guatemala, Dominican Republic, Chile, and Indonesia in favor of military thugs was justified in terms of narrowly defined Western interests. Pat Buchanan defends a similar approach to foreign policy. Like North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms, he believes that Americans can't do too much to isolate Castro's Cuba, but he has no bitter words for right-wing dictatorships, past or present. Buchanan's historical reflections should give us pause about the morality of starting this millennium with the mindset that prevailed for the last century. If we are to avoid giving support to the equivalents of Hitler, we need to broaden our understanding of Western interests to make democracy and justice, rather than free enterprise, the touchstones of support for a regime.
You've been listening to Alvin Finkel, professor of history at Athabasca University in Alberta, Canada. Finkel is the co-author of In Our Time, The Chamberlain-Hitler Collusion. His op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. There are a number of good programs coming up on the History Channel we'd like to alert you to. You may remember the movie The Bridge on the River Kwai. It was a great movie, but sorry to say, it was largely fictional. To find out what really happened in the construction of the 255-mile Thailand-to-Burma Railroad, tune in The True Story of the Bridge on the River Kwai on Monday evening, May 1st. On Tuesday, May 2nd, discover the history of a shadowy liaison between the U.S. Naval Intelligence, the Office of Strategic Services, and the Army with the New York and Sicilian Mafia during World War II in Project Underworld, The Military and the Mafia. And on Wednesday, May 3rd, watch U.S. Invaded, the story of the few actual armed invasions of America, not just by the British, as is well known, but by Mexico's Pancho Villa and the Japanese. Got your attention? Remember, these shows are all on the History Channel, and be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look at the golden age of radio. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear a word they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stop and stare. I can't see the faces. Only the shadows of their eyes.